Hello and welcome to Running on Joy with Francesca Goodwin, the podcast that celebrates putting one foot in front of the other in whatever form that takes. This is a podcast that explores how we can live in a more connected, creative and compassionate manner for the benefit of our communities, our planet and our own mental and physical health. I'm your host, Francesca Goodwin, and every week I'll be asking a new interviewee what joy means to them. Running on Joy is ad-free, but if you enjoy the show, please do take a moment to leave a review and give feedback wherever you listen to your podcasts. You might also consider supporting the work of Running on Joy guest Dan Lawson through Rubbish Shoes and Rerun Clothing to end the cycle of wastage in the sports clothing and footwear industries. Follow at Rubbish Shoes and at rerun.clothing on Instagram for further information. Hello everyone. My guest today specializes in working in remote and hostile environments as a highly experienced filmmaker and photographer. Having begun their career creating short research-based films for the United Nations and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, they fell in love with life on the road and expedition filmmaking. They hold a few strings to their bow and are the host of the Adventure Podcast, an ongoing series of long-form conversations with pioneers of exploration and discovery. They are also creative director of Cold House, a content agency and platform for authentic storytelling. Cold House really reflects their passion for seeking out untold stories and learning from working in extreme environments. No concept is too complex or location too remote for them. It's my delight. This has been a little while coming, having been initially connected through Kendall Mountain Festival, so a shout out to them, to finally make some time to sit down with them and now welcome them to Running in Joy and invite them to introduce themselves in the manner of their choosing. Hello.
Hello, thank you very much. I'm Matt Bycroft. I think you covered it all pretty comprehensively. There's a lot I could add, and I guess maybe we'll go into it in this conversation, but that covers it.
Happy to connect at last. So as I mentioned, this has taken a little while to set up our chat. So how has the past year been for you?
Well, it's kind of a big question. I mean, I'll give you as succinct an answer as I can. So whilst, you know, my online presence and bio would imply that I'm dangling off ropes and climbing mountains and skiing a lot, I'm also a father to two very tiny children, a three-year-old and a one-year-old, and my wife's a professional musical theatre soprano, so she's working full-time in the West End. So the last year for me, I've spent a lot of it at home, and that's new for me. I've spent most of the last 10 years on the road, and I struggled with that at the start for all the kind of obvious reasons, but I've really settled into it now. I'm loving being a father. I'm loving growing food in my back garden. I'm loving living out of a wardrobe rather than a duffel bag. Perhaps disappointing in some ways as an answer, I'm at home a lot, which I'm thrilled with. But as well as that, I've also been overseas a little bit. My career took a fairly major turn a couple of years ago. My dream was always to direct films for National Geographic. That was when I was 19, that was what I wanted to do. And 2 years ago, I got the call. I never expected it to happen. So I did the first one a couple of years ago, but then last summer, 2023, I went off to Alaska with Alex Honnold of Free Solo fame, and Tommy Caldwell, one of the best rock climbers in the world, to go and direct a feature film for National Geographic. So that was my summer. Outside of that, I've been recording podcasts, making other movies, but mostly desk-based, which I'm, as I say, enjoying.
Have you always been someone for whom life is a little bit topsy-turvy and a lot of plate spinning at the same time?
Yeah. My mum calls it Lego syndrome. That was what she called it when I was little. So I was the kid who would, I'd get the Lego, I'd follow the instructions, I'd build it, and then I'd never play with it. I would take it apart and build something else. I think I'm a serial builder of things. I'm kind of a bit of a schemer and a dreamer. And I think, as we were talking about before we press record, I don't really know how to say no, which is something I've been working on in my 30s. I think my 20s were defined by everything I said yes to, and my 30s, it seems, are more defined by what I'm saying no to, which is something I'm struggling to learn. So serial plate spinner is definitely a title I would accept. And I just think sometimes that creates problems in my life, but most of the time, I'm quite squirrel brained, I'm quite reactive, I'm quite emotional. I tend to follow my heart rather than my head. So yes, I have lots of plate spinning, but that keeps me curious, engaged, and excited. I think I've ruined myself for ever getting a proper job. I don't think I could do it now.
Well, I think your job is very proper, but and we were talking a little bit before we hit record about sharing vulnerabilities and the importance of men talking about those vulnerabilities as well. And do you find that it's that time in between the spinning plates, perhaps, that you struggle with the most? I'm just curious how you've dealt with those in the past and what happens when Matt isn't on the go button?
I mean, it's fascinating. It's like you've been talking to my therapist. Yeah, I mean, you've actually hit the nail on the head completely. I think my therapist, who, I spent a lot of time with her 5 or 6 years ago, and my wife continues to say to me, it's the sometimes I hide behind my work. And that's not always true. I think the line between work and passion for me, it doesn't actually exist. I've stopped trying to find it. It's too blurry. I'm quite content working in the evenings because often what I'm doing is writing film treatments or editing movies or coming up with new ideas, and I love that. But it's definitely the downtime is where I struggle the most, and I've definitely struggled with my mental health over the years. I continue to, actually, to be totally honest. I've sort of, through therapy, learned that I think I'm on some sort of bipolar spectrum. I definitely am not bipolar, but I have these huge ups and these huge downs, and I've learned how to manage them. But actually how to utilize them. And that was where the therapy was amazing, was we can go into this if you'd like to. It's not important to me to do so, but equally I'm happy to, of why I needed therapy. But I had a fairly major mental health breakdown, and the therapist, she ended up saying to me, "It seems to me you have two states, and they are ecstatic euphoria and contemplative melancholy, and you kind of can't exist without either of them. The ecstatic euphoria is where you do your best work. It's where you feel like the gold cogs are whirring and everything's brilliant. And the contemplative melancholy, you tend to feel sad, but actually, she suspects it's because I'm not running at 100 miles an hour, which is my preferred state. And so I feel like I should be moving. I feel like it's like this hustle culture, which I feel like is ingrained in me. And actually learning to slow down and enjoy the contemplative moments, enjoy doing nothing, is something I am continuing to learn how to do. So I used to be scared of stopping. Now I consciously stop and I kind of enjoy the discomfort. I learn to live with the discomfort. And I think taking myself a lot less seriously and recognizing I'm not as important as I used to think I was, has been a major help.
That's so interesting. Thank you so much for sharing that. That's really helpful. And I think from my own experience as well, I can de everything that you say completely resonates. That sort of flip between either ecstatic, high energy, and then those periods where it's like, oh, how do I deal with sitting with myself and not constantly distracting myself from myself? And sometimes in really productive ways, and ways that reach people and communicate and do these on the surface really is kind of, amazing things that people connect with and praise you for. And so you keep doing the thing because that's the thing that gets the attention and the resonance in the world, but actually just being not necessarily still, but less preoccupied with that. It's really difficult. So it's a reason that meditation itself is really difficult because you just can't sit still and face the thing that they're not running from necessarily, but are needing distraction from, which is how we feel.
Yeah.
And we talk about feelings, I think, sometimes in quite a surface level, in society in general, but to actually know and feel them, that's a whole other kettle of fish, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, and that was something I had to learn how to do. And it would be funny, I'd almost, well, I should probably will, but I'd love my wife to listen to this because I'm almost a different person now to the person pre-therapy. I mean, I had a very happy childhood in lots of senses, but I was also very, very unhappy as a teenager. I was quite badly bullied at school, and I grew up in a world where the only emotion that boys have is anger. You know, big boys don't cry. Come on, it doesn't hurt, does it? Come on, jump off that cliff into the sea. You know, and anger was the only negative emotion I was taught how to experience by society, I think. And I think that's true to this day. I think lots of men experience that. And you know, post therapy, even now, I have moments where I'll get angry and my wife will say, "Are you definitely angry?" And I'll go, "No, I'm embarrassed," or "No, I'm confused," or "No, I'm actually just really sad." I go, "Oh, okay, yeah, that's better." Well, I can kind of deal with that emotion now because I understand the emotion. That means I can work out where it's coming from. And if possible, I can remedy it. I can work out how to fix whatever's broken or just accept that that thing that's happened is sad. I don't need to be so angry and fiery about it. But without those that contemplative downtime, I'd just be all fiery and angry and then move on to the next thing.
And still just label that thing as anger rather than the nuanced feelings that are underneath it, right?
Or not even label it. Just that was just that was I think that's the difference between the two states for me is one is almost flow-like, you know, that ecstatic euphoria. I'm not slowing down to think. The thinking is happening, it's reactions. I'm just reacting. Particularly as a creative person, I kind of go, "I've got an idea. Right, let's write that thing down. Let's plan that. Let's do this." Whereas slowing down and saying, "Is that really what I want to do? What do I want to achieve today? What do I want to achieve tomorrow? What do I want to achieve in my life?" And I mean, that's a whole different topic of conversation is achievement and success, you know, that, you know, what do those things mean to me? To give you a quick example of, you know, the sort of thing I'm proud of these days is, you know, when my baby wakes up at 8 p.m. when I'm in the middle of writing something or watching TV or having some downtime, I used to get quite grumpy about that, not with the child, but I would be grumpy in my head. And now, instead, I go and pick up the baby, sit down in the chair, and I just say, "I won't be able to do this forever. You know, this is a privilege being able to hold this little creature and comfort them and give them what they need. That's a positive thing for me to do. That's a it's a privilege and it's a joy. And I should use this as an opportunity to like be present in the moment with my son, rather than that selfish focus of, well, it was just getting to the good bit on Netflix." And I think so much of this stuff we're talking about is reframing how we view situations. And you know, I don't necessarily want to turn this into a self-help conversation, but I have learned that I can control my reactions to things. And that this whole idea, one of the things I disagree with some of the self-help style books or conversations is that our reactions are authentic. Well, of course they're authentic. That doesn't mean we can't change them. And that's what's, I mean, in a way, saved me, changed me, made me happy, healthy, able to function as part of a family is altering how my brain reacts.
Or we can change the actions that are a product of the reactions. Like we can't help what we feel in a moment, but we can decide and do have autonomy over how we direct and act upon that feeling, don't we?
Yes.
And I'm interested just to wind us back, because it's kind of serendipitous that you were saying about, okay, so what might constitute sort of like what you were encouraged as a younger person to think of as being a man and kind of how you feel and things. And then obviously there is the kind of stereotype around what adventure means as well. And obviously, you know, you run the adventure podcast, adventure is sort of your career. So I'm interested in kind of like this journey from when you were younger with the outdoors and then the kind of the draw to adventure and what the lure of that was for you, whether it was connected at all with channeling some of these feelings that you had that were just kind of in the bag of anger and things, or whether it was actually something that was different.
I mean, in some ways, I am the teenage boy cliche. So I was sent on Outward Bound, you know, the outdoor recreation center, by school. And you know, I can see exactly now why they sent me. And to cut a very long story short, I ended up going on this 3 week residential in Scotland, and I just had the most amazing experience. I was exposed to mountains, climbing, kayaking, camping, journeying, traveling, adventure. Some of it was part of the team. They'd send you on a little solo. When they found me at the end of my solo, I was sat in my boxer shorts on the shore of a lake, having covered myself in war paint from all the fire ashes the next day, age 16. There was something going on in my brain that needed to be outdoors and connecting to that kind of ancestral, primal feeling of spending time outdoors, which I had had as a child. My parents, we used to go to Cornwall every summer and jump off cliffs and go in the sea. Like, I was exposed to the outdoors and adventure, but not in the way that lots of my friends now were, growing up in adventurous places. I'm from Grimsby, born on what I affectionately refer to as the arse of England. It just sticks out and there it is, and there's nothing there. And I haven't been back since I was 16 years old. And I'm lost. Where were we? Oh, what was the lure? Well, I went back from those 3 weeks, and I'd just done my GCSEs, 16-year-old exams, and I got off the train, and my mum had the results in a paper envelope, and I said to her, and they were both nervous. And I don't know whether or not I should say this, but I was predicted 12 A stars as a student, and I didn't put any effort into my exams or my coursework. I was very badly bullied. I didn't go to school in year 11, and I got nothing like that result. But I'd said to mum before she opened the envelope, it doesn't matter. I'm moving to the Lake District at the start of September, and I'm going to study a course in outdoor education. My plan was to become an outdoor leader. That was what I wanted to be. I wanted to be the person that had just taken me on that experience. Anyway, fast forward a long time, and I lived in Cumbria for 7 years. I studied a degree in adventure media, but I spent the whole time I was there exploring the Lake District with my friends, and we were terrible at everything. And I say that, half as a joke, but half because it didn't matter. We were going climbing easy routes and getting it wrong. We were walking up hills and getting benighted. We were getting lost. We were going kayaking and flipping over, but we were being adventurous. We didn't realize it, but we were going on these wild adventures, which were the equivalent of, Chris Bonington on Everest for him. But for us, it was this like unexplored wilderness that was at our doorstep, and we didn't know how to use it properly. So we were getting it wrong. And that pull of, we're going to go out now, having done as much prep as we're able to do, given our age and skill set, and see what happens. It all goes wrong. We deal with that as a group. We go home with our tail between our legs and get warm and have some food. It was addictive. And I understand now. I mean, as you say, I have spent my whole life focused on the worlds of adventure, and particularly the last sort of 5 to 7 years, focused kind of philosophically and intellectually on this idea of adventure. I can now see what it was we were getting. Sense of purpose, sense of community, sense of confidence, and a connection to nature, which I will champion and shout from the rooftops as, one of the best things for a human being.
Well, it sounds like that nature and finding that space that was adventurous but a safe space as well was a really kind of healing experience, really, for want of a better word.
Yeah, I mean, it's potentially tangential, but I left everything behind me. I got to reinvent myself. So I didn't have to be this insecure. I mean, you talk about masculinity. I didn't have to be this insecure. I was 5 foot 3 until I was 16. And then I just grew to 5 foot 10, and my shoulders got big in one summer, almost literally in one summer. And so I arrived, and I sort of looked how I do now, but I had a lot more hair and no beard. And I could just pretend to be somebody else. And I pretended to be what I thought a man was, which was strong and brave and stoic and adventurous and unemotional. And I didn't talk about my feelings. I didn't talk about the past. I didn't cry, obviously, because men don't cry. God forbid we ever cry. And that's who I became. And I was that for a very long time. It became true. And then the wheels fell off, but that's a whole different conversation.
And it sounds like also that adventure came through failure. And failure, right, it makes the best stories, doesn't it? I mean, it's great when things go right, but the best anecdotes come from failure. So, in something that was, again, a very vulnerable experience, and knowing that you could kind of pick yourself up and go home and all share in the glory of that brilliant failure where you'd got lost or something. I imagine perhaps were there seeds sown for being a storyteller as well?
That's a really good question. And that, I think a lot of this I've kind of got it worked out. I've spent so long thinking about it outside of the therapy room. I mean, I'm quite a I'm a I'm an overanalyzer and a thinker. So I've thought about this stuff, but where the storytelling came from is actually something I haven't really considered much. I mean, I think I never considered myself creative or artistic at school. I wasn't very good at English and art were probably my worst subjects. And I think the storytelling, I honestly think that probably it was ingrained in me and I didn't know it was there. It was sitting dormant. I mean, I studied adventure media by accident. I didn't have the qualifications to do the degree I wanted to do. I failed to get into the Royal Marines, which is what I thought I was then going to do because I broke my arm. Was permanently damaged. And I got onto this degree program and fell in love with photography very quickly. But the sort of photography I fell in love with was human. It was documenting people in landscape. I didn't realize that at the time, but absolutely, I can see that's what it was now. And then very quickly, I wanted to try and understand how to communicate those experiences of what those people had. I didn't want to show them doing things. I wanted to understand what they were doing and why and how it made them feel. And so I think it was this almost organic process of falling in love with stories and storytelling. I mean, I was a pretty voracious reader when I was younger. I loved fiction, loved fantasy. I loved the Lord of the Rings and Harry Potter when I was a little kid. That was always there. And I am still a bit of a geek at heart. I love stories. And I find myself able to sort of read anything fictitious and enjoy it. So, yeah, a long-winded way of saying I think it's just sort of always been there and I tapped into it accidentally.
When I was younger, I always thought, well, for quite a long time actually, that voracious and vicarious were the same word. And I kind of love that now because reading voraciously allows you to live vicariously through
Totally.
people.
Yeah.
And it's interesting you saying about kind of reinventing yourself through kind of the stories that you were living in the Lake District, in that landscape. It was kind of like a way of being and living through stories, even if you didn't realize it at that moment in time. So living
Yeah.
vicariously and voraciously.
Yeah. Yeah, I think if I can add as well, I think actually it's just come to me now. I feel quite self-aware in terms of my strengths and weaknesses. And again, I think that's come through all the self-discovery and exploration I've had to do, but I think I've always been curious. It was actually why I was bullied at school was I put my hand up a lot and I asked questions a lot. And I've always been curious about everything. And I still now I can have a conversation about anything and I'll generally find it interesting. I love musical theatre. Right. I would never have considered myself a fan, but then my wife works in that world. I don't just go because she likes it now. I'm passionate about it. If you look at my bookshelves, they're an eclectic, kind of lunatic collection of all sorts of weird things. And so I think that curiosity is what's led to this storytelling. Because I don't really see myself as a storyteller. It's language I use, but I see myself more as a curator and an archivist, and I feel more like with the podcast particularly, I'm not telling stories. I'm enabling the tales to be told. And I remind myself of that quite regularly in terms of my podcast style. And I feel like what I'm doing instead is, having these conversations with people, I was having them anyway, on porta ledges, on mountains, in airports, in pubs, and it felt like an injustice that I got to hear them and no one else did. And so essentially what I did was I picked up two microphones and I carried on having the conversations. So am I telling a story or am I archiving and curating a story for others to listen to? That feels like more of an important goal for me than storytelling. And that plays into where my career is at now as a filmmaker, because I feel like my filmmaking these days is actually an exercise in leadership. It's an idea and a spark and then bringing a team of talented people together to craft that story. Again, it's a whole different subject, but it's an interesting one. I'm not a lone wolf. It doesn't motivate me. I'm very rarely motivated by almost like the things I want to do, if that makes sense. I like building teams and seeing them do amazing things.
There's a few interesting things there, because I think I definitely again connect that idea of sort of being like a conduit kind of with a podcast or something. Like anyone will tell you that my anecdotes are dreadful because I can't remember the names of anything. And so just all kind of like falls flat on its face. But in order for stories to be told, there needs to be someone asking the questions, right? And holding the space for those to unravel. So I think that's certainly something that I can connect with in terms of actually podcasting being a space where I feel like I can be creative in a way that isn't necessarily telling my shit anecdotes.
Yeah.
But then also in terms of like you working collaboratively, this is sort of jumping on a tangent to the linear story that's going on. But you mentioned kind of like this idea of sort of getting away from what was kind of quite egotistical, or you were saying, or maybe narcissistic might be another word, of kind of feeling that, oh, don't interrupt my Netflix watching, and having those feelings of anger. And it's interesting that you've now gravitated towards this very much a kind of like leading a team of people who are generating these ideas. And how have you sort of found that transition?
I mean, I can't overemphasize how brilliant it's been. excuse me. Like radically transformative for the better. I think I was wildly insecure as a young man because I didn't know who I was. I was pretending to be somebody else, and it wasn't real or authentic because I didn't know who I was. I mean, to jump forward to it now, I still have an ego. Everyone has an ego. I just think mine's got a really safe lockbox and I know when to look at it and when to be scared of it. I also am still wildly insecure in lots of ways. And I think this is true of lots of people. And I call it the ego seesaw. It's just, I'm trying to find this equilibrium between ego and imposter syndrome. And either of those things will completely cripple you. So it's just finding that balance between the two. And I focus on that quite a lot, like check in with myself. Am I making this too much about me? Do I think I'm brilliant versus I'm a worthless piece of shit and I don't deserve any of this? And I've only got this far because I've got a big mouth and actually I've got no skill or talent. Like somewhere in between those two things is the truth. But I found that I desperately needed to be noticed when I was younger. I wanted to be seen. I almost wanted to be famous. I wanted to be talented and brilliant and celebrated. And then, I've been lucky and fortunate. I mean, I've worked hard, right? There's a difference between luck and chance. And I think, I've stacked the odds in my favor in certain ways. I've worked very hard for a very long time, but we've won awards for our films. And I've stood on stage and collected those awards and had people clap at me. I didn't get much out of that. At the end of the day, I really didn't. And the feedback of my closest friends and peers means a lot to me because they know me well enough to know they can be kindly critical. They can say, Matt, I think this film's awesome. Why did you do this instead of that? What would have happened if you'd done this? And I love those conversations. But recently, one of my closest friends, Emma Crome, who also works at Cold House as creative director. She won an award for a film she was directing at Kendall, one of the bigger awards there. And the whole team went on stage to collect the award, and I stood at the back of the room very deliberately because I didn't make that film. I wasn't really involved. I exec produced it. I came up with the concept and I got the money, and then I stepped away and I watched the room clap at Emma, and I felt more proud in that moment than I ever have stood on a stage. And I feel like this kind of death of ego and enabling others to be brilliant and to be celebrated gives me so much more than being celebrated myself. And that might sound, I'm aware that to members of the audience, that might sound insincere, but I honestly am telling the truth. I think it's partly having had this mental health breakdown and the subsequent therapy, it's experiencing this ego death. I generally, having interviewed a lot of people and made a lot of films, I mean, I've probably done 500 to 700 interviews in my career, and there is definitely a correlation between insecurity and aspiring for success in traditional terms, I think.
Oh, yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And I think, kind of part of that, it's interesting that you frame it also in terms of your mental health crisis, because I think sometimes those kind of breakdowns can feel like they've suddenly been thrust upon us. And suddenly, having been used to being the one asking the questions and also being able to problem solve finding the answers, suddenly you don't have the answers. And you're the one being asked the questions that you don't necessarily have the words for. And I think that can be a humbling and potentially like transformative experience in a way, if you're going to reframe it in a positive context.
Totally.
Not that anyone would wish it upon anyone at all, but
No, I mean, I would. My only call to arms that I would do is, since I started talking more regularly online about having had therapy, and particularly in my own podcast, I do talk about it a little bit when it's relevant. I've had quite a lot of, particularly men, but sometimes women, message to say they have now booked a session or they're now 3 sessions in. And, that gives me the warm and fuzzies. Of course it does, but I'm realizing more and more that A, talking about it does help others, and B, I mean, everybody could do with some form of, call it whatever you want, call it therapy, call it counseling, call it coaching, depending on where you're at. I think it's very rare that a person can sit there and say, I have 100% completely and totally got all of my shit together and I need no help. I would say that's arrogance. I would say that's just, it can't be true. So I'm not suggesting everybody listening to this should run out and get a therapist, but I am saying, anyone who's struggling with anything or feels like they need support and have the financial means to do so, talk to somebody. It's amazing what it'll do.
And thinking about kind of not always having your ducks necessarily in a row, am I right in thinking that your kind of career trajectory was very much kind of learning through working on the job, really? I was wondering if you could kind of reflect on that, and also sort of when you started working on films or making your stuff straight away, kind of maybe not, I imagine, necessarily being able to make the thing that you had aspired to be, the kind of the award-winning magnum opus that was going to be straight off the bat. How do you then sort of mediate those expectations? And then what was the process, and what did you get from actually learning through, I guess, what might have been quite a few mistakes as well?
Thousands of mistakes. I mean, I'm a big believer in, I make mistakes all the time. Some of them are conscious, like I set myself up to fail just to see how I can do. But yeah, I think there's a line between blind arrogance and taking chances or putting yourself in a situation where you really don't know how you're going to do something. And I am willing to put a little bit of gender into this. I get this kind of like white male confidence that is a thing. I've definitely had that throughout my 20s. And, the first sort of professional job, one of the first professional jobs I ever got, I'd been taking lots of stills and photographs, but I hadn't really been making films. And I lied. I maybe shouldn't use that language, but it was a half truth because he said to me, I've got this edit. I need it done within 2 weeks. Can you do it? And I said, yeah, because in my head, I thought, well, I can. I just need to learn a lot in order to do it, but I'll work it out. And I actually took a, this shows my age a little bit, because rather than Googling it, I took a book, How to Edit in Final Cut Pro 7. I was going away to Fontainebleau to go bouldering in France for 2 weeks. And I took my laptop and I took this book and I learned how to edit in a tent. And I spent, 10 times as long as I should have taken on this edit, but I learned how to make a movie. And with hindsight, that movie is terrible, but it did the job that he needed it to do. And I think it's so easy to look up. I could give you names right now. I mean, Jimmy Chin, who directed Free Solo, if I compared my work to him, I would be constantly miserable. I don't have an Oscar. I'm probably never going to win an Oscar. But instead, it's this, and this is, again, it's a bit cheesy, but it's that constant betterment. That's what I'm looking for, is this one better than the last one? If not, that can be okay, but why isn't it? Did I not put as much effort into it? Did I pick the wrong project? But I think what I try to do is be realistic about my abilities, but push myself a little bit within the parameters of what's sensible and reasonable. And I think it, I don't quite have a clever answer, for anyone who's not confident or able to do that, but I like to challenge and push myself. And I think that's because I'm not scared of failure anymore. I think fear of failure is like one of the biggest barriers to what we might talk about. Success is a funny word. I don't really like it, but barriers to success, like fear of failure. I mean, I know that this podcast has its origins in running. Imagine a world where you decide you're just going to go and run a marathon. And so you just think, well, and actually, I'm going to win. I'm going to win the marathon. Like, that's lunacy. But saying in 10 years, I'd quite like to win a marathon, that is probably achievable for almost anybody. But with 10 years, yeah, sure. I mean, I tried to run the, I'm a runner. I'm not a very good one. I go running. I actually don't like to call myself a runner. That's an interesting, I go running a lot. I tried to run the Dragon's Back race, 6 days, the full length of Wales. I failed miserably. I got acute IT band syndrome in both legs. I got shin splints and I got dehydrated. I made loads of mistakes. I wasn't that upset by it. So I learned lots of things. I'm planning to run the Dragon's Back again in a couple of years, not this year, but in a couple of years, building up to it. And I think goals are amazing things to have. And, cheesy line number seven of this conversation is, goals enable a journey. I think that's, that mountains will, if mountains teach you anything, it's that the summit is almost always disappointing. Almost always, even if the sunset's perfect, which it often isn't. When you reflect, when I reflect on all of the expeditions I've been on, the summit just does not feature in my brain. Hardly ever. What I remember is, that sip of whiskey at 9 p.m. after a really hard day sat in base camp, or the conversation I had with a friend, or that photograph I took, or that particular stretch of jungle. And that is it's a brilliant metaphor for anything we do. I think about it with films as well. That's why the awards don't mean anything. Not nothing, but they don't mean much to me. They're better for my CV than they are for my brain. I actually, when I think about films, I remember the journey that I went on with my friends to go and make them. I remember the eureka moment of this is how we connect that scene to that scene. And often those, I would say for me, particularly personally, because I'm an extrovert, I'm very extroverted, I'm very conversational, and I'm very tactile. I'm a people person through and through in every way. And for me, every positive memory I conjure up over the course of my career involves other people, everyone.
And actually, as I was listening to you reflect on that, the words in my head were, this is about human experience and connection over just purely observation, which you differentiated earlier in the conversation, talking about it's not just about taking these wide pan images of a landscape. It's about the very human stories that are about the experience of moving through that landscape with others.
Totally. I mean, to get into the creative slightly, I'd say that's why I'm not a journalist. I actually spent some time as a journalist early on in my career running around Africa, sub-Saharan Africa. And in some ways it was brilliant, in some ways it was harrowing, but creatively it wasn't as stimulating for me as what I do now. And for some people it is. You look at the Don McCulloughs of this world, they're observational photographers in that sense, they're journalists, they're documenting exactly what happens. I am comfortable saying that I definitely put a lot of myself in the work that I create. Other people are the conduit for these stories, and they're their stories. Of course they are, but we're editing them, we're directing them, and so of course there's something of us in these tales. And I increasingly realize, I mean, is it an accident that the last project I did was about alpha males and men's mental health? It doesn't take a genius to look at that film and see that the director, if you know him, is talking about himself. Not out of ego. It's a journey of discovery. I have enjoyed making that film because of the philosophy involved. This is, again, it's a tangential subject, but I made a film about a queer photographer, a guy called Hamish Frost. Is it a coincidence that I made that film with Emma directing, both of us directing, at a time where I was coming to terms with my own sexuality and having those conversations with other people? No, it's not a coincidence. That so much of the films, so much of the work that I do is around identity and purpose. Is that a coincidence? No, of course it's not. I feel very purposeful now and like I understand my identity, but that's a new thing.
What you were saying there about kind of bringing the personal into these projects. And I wonder, how do you balance? Because obviously your work is also commercial, and you need to get funds from somewhere in order to realize these films. Like, how do you balance kind of when working with a brand, say, kind of representing that brand or the project brief, whilst also producing something that's kind of genuine and organic in feeling, which your work is?
Yeah, I think it's interesting for me that it varies pretty wildly. So, and nothing I say here is intended as negative, just in case any of my clients are listening. But working on the National Geographic projects, I understand that I'm a piece in a puzzle. So, if you were to use a sort of military analogy, I'm like the captain, and there are lots of majors and colonels and generals above me who are making big decisions and telling me what to do. My creative control is very limited on a project like that, but I understand that. So I'm not going in naive. I do the best job I can, and I've been given these guardrails. When it comes to my own work and the work I do through Cold House, I founded Cold House 10 years ago, and at the start, we'd sort of do anything. Whereas now, it's very rare that we shoot a product video or a commercial in the true sense of the word. We would do them. Because we do a lot of projects a year and it's a business. But I think what we've become known for and where our passion kind of lies is in human storytelling and what the industry calls branded entertainment. So if you were to take the logo off most of the films we make, it's a watchable documentary. It's a story. They are documentary films, branded documentaries. And I think we've become sort of known for that in the industry. I'm really proud of that. So most of the regular clients that come to us, they come to us to tell high-end stories. We've just had a project signed off today to tell five stories. All the product stuff is being dealt with by another agency, but they want some storytellers to come and make some films. So I've been given major guardrails with that project. I know exactly where we're going. I've been told which square mile we're going to. I'm being told who the characters are. My job is to find an interesting story within each of those characters. But then I have to ask the question, do you want deep, dark stories? Do you want positive, empowering stories? Do you want light, loose stories? That's a question I have to ask. So, I sometimes, if I do too much back-to-back client work, need a bit of a creative boost from somewhere else because whilst I genuinely, love and really get off on most of the work that I do, I sometimes need to just do my own thing. But I find I have that with the podcast quite regularly. I'm completely the captain of that ship. Nobody tells me what to do ever. And that's totally of me. So that gives me a lot of creative autonomy. But I think the joy with, I'd say, like 50% of our clients now, particularly two or three who've been with us for 7 or 8 years, they just come to us. It's amazing, really. I think it's quite rare. They come to us at the start of a season and they say, we've got X budget to spend. What do you think we should do? And we'll say, well, what are your goals for the season? We ask all the right agency questions, but then we'll come up with seven ideas and they'll vary really wildly in scope and scale. Sometimes it's a series, sometimes it's a feature. We're essentially getting paid to tell the stories we want to tell because we're generating the concepts ourselves. So, I mean, that is a very fortunate position to be in. I recognize that. I think it's very rare.
And it's interesting that, I mean, you mentioned the word love there, because I this was kind of again percolating in the back of my mind, as you were talking before. But there's an inordinate amount of pressure and stress that can come, one from, working to a brief and deadlines and things, but also, as you reflected on that journey and the failures that you encounter and the projects that don't go right and the ones that you want to make but can't and all of that, one must love the process to keep doing it, the love fueling the journey. So I guess the big question is really, what is it about film that you love?
You know what? I don't know on impulse. I think if I were, my gut response is community storytelling, actually. I think really, I'm more naturally a photographer, and I'm more naturally kind of a conversationalist than I am a filmmaker. I think if you were to sit down with lots of the people I work with on film projects, they'd actually say I don't do much. Apart from when we're on the ground. And I think that's true. I'm very much an ideas man in the film world, and I like to watch edits and feedback on them, but I don't really cut much anymore. I think what I love about film is generating a concept. I quite enjoy sales, actually. It's as boring as that sounds. I like selling ideas and pitching ideas and talking passionately about them. And then I love building a team. I love that part. And I used to kind of joke that I seem to sort of have a magnet for like no-hopers, jokers, and rogues. They sort of gravitate towards me. But I like that. I like that, I've sort of got these waifs and strays of the world coming and making these things with me, probably because I definitely identify as one of those people. And I don't want to do everyone I work with a disservice. They're all incredible professionals, but they're as loose as they are good at being professional. Building those teams and then working with them closely. And I think I've worked a little bit with some specialists on basically how to function in difficult scenarios, which has been a privilege, alongside ex special forces operators and intelligence officers and stuff. And as a remote location specialist, the thing I actually love when I'm in the field directing for National Geographic is problem solving with high functioning teams. I think at the core of what I love is being a part of a high functioning team. I think if I'm being really honest, it just so happens that film is that medium. I don't think that's by design. I think I could easily be doing something else. It just so happens that I'm 15 years into this and I really enjoy it. But I'm not the natural artist. It's not the art of film that I'm obsessed with.
And you described, I mean, you mentioned when a member of your team was going up on stage and receiving the award. That sounded like a moment of what could be called awe at them doing that. And it's interesting that you then reflect on it as that collaborative element that you like about the film rather than necessarily the artistry of it. But awe is another A word that goes hand in hand with adventure, really. So I just want to think about that aspect of it and the fact that your projects do take you to these also these incredible locations and extreme locations at that. Could you, without kind of getting you to do a whole full potted history of everything you've ever done, are there any moments of awe that stand out to you from those locations in themselves?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I mean, I won't dwell on this, but it immediately tells you everything I've just said is true, that I gravitate towards moments shared with friends. But moments of awe when it comes to, I mean, some of them are the natural world and some of them aren't actually. So, I mean, again, gut response, being in Guyana on Mount Roraima, which, if anybody's seen the Disney film Up, it was inspired by Mount Roraima, sitting on a porter ledge. A sort of hanging tent, 400 meters above the jungle, at sunrise, drinking coffee, looking out over this vast, pristine Amazon rainforest, from this impossible location. Humans sort of shouldn't be there. That I'd say is as close to awe, I think, as it's possible to get. But then I've been really lucky. I've been down to Antarctica twice and seeing the beauty of the Antarctic Peninsula and the wildlife there. I mean, I've been so fortunate with the projects I've worked on in terms of the diversity of locations, but also the adventurous experiences and the wildlife encounters. So I've swum with grey whales. I've filmed orca 5 meters from the boat. I've watched eagles circling overhead and chasing my drone in Panama. The place I love most in the world outside of the UK, because I always say Scotland is the best place in the world, is Wadi Rum in Jordan, and I think it looks like Mars. It's not an accident that they filmed Star Wars there in The Martian, and just these incredible wind carved, because they are, it used to be an ocean. It's all sandstone, so these wind carved towers, and the way the light hits them, everything just turns rose gold. The sand's rose gold. I mean, It's just spectacular. But then to flip it around completely, and this is, I don't talk about this online much, but if you go digging, it is there. You know, I spent a week illegally living in Chernobyl, following a load of urban explorers around, and we only explored by night because it's illegal to be there, and we didn't want to get chased by the military. And seeing Chernobyl, you know, it's dark tourism. I've talked about that a lot on Instagram. If anybody wants to criticize me, go back and read my posts before you email me, but then feel free to email me. The seeing nature recover, like, I'm pretty passionate about the natural world, what we've done to it, and what we're going to continue to do to it, and how we can change that. And connecting people to nature and understanding it. But I think Chernobyl is an amazing example of kind of hopeful recovery. I foxes were just walking about on the tarmac. You know, we could see them out of the windows. We could hear moose kind of rutting in the trees. I'm gonna, is it moose? I can't remember. Might be, get my get, I'll have to get I'm not an animal person, as you can tell.
I
But
had this
what?
exact conversation the other day. I was like, what's the plural of moose? It's moose,
I was
I
thinking it's meese. If goose is geese, moose must be meese.
think. Yeah. Meese. You saw the meeses.
But there were trees growing through the tarmac, and that blew my mind. You know, this is a nature experience, right? Seeing nature reclaim this town despite its darkness and why it happened. It just showed, like, the power of the natural world and its ability to heal itself if we just left it alone is quite profound.
And something that is evolving and on a journey itself. It's interesting that you pick that as a standout moment rather than something that is simply an Instagrammable moment. You kind of have to be there and think about the whole context of it and what is actually happening in terms of that reclamation, rather than just oh, there's a whale, there's an eagle kind of thing.
I should also say, and this is maybe an unpopular thing to say, that, you know, phrase it carefully, I have been so fortunate to have traveled the world. You know, God knows how many countries, I haven't counted. I don't know if I could. I'd probably forget a load. I've seen a lot of sunsets over mountains. I've seen a lot of beautiful things, and the law of diminishing returns does exist. And eventually, you know, it's that overexposure. I have been slightly overexposed to beauty, awe, and wonder, and I have to really force myself to notice things now, because for 10 years it was almost every day. We don't notice the beauty, awe, and wonder around us when we walk through the streets of Britain or wander through a forest, because we see it every day. So when you've been up a lot of mountains and seen a lot of sunsets from them, they start to blur. And I think that's why I sort of started to struggle to come up with specific examples for you, is it's all just been amazing. It's been hard. There's been some darkness. There's been some storms. I've been in a lot of storms. But, well, that's actually quite a good answer. The beauty of storms, that's something that's overlooked. When you can hardly move, you can hardly see, there's actually the power of nature. Water's the same, powerful water, heavy water. That's an inspiring, awe-filled moment. I like being lost. I like feeling safe amongst the power of nature. That is very special. Tents are good places to be in storms. If that doesn't fill you with awe and fear, not a lot will.
And that feeling of, again, it's that humility, isn't it? In the face of, and that is the definition of awe, really, that idea of something that is just so much bigger than you and that you are powerless.
Yeah, it's an antidote to conquest, I think. I'm so anti-conquest when we think about the outdoors and mountains. And I have an older friend. He'd hate me saying older friend, but he is an older friend, a bit older than me, Matt Sharman, who's been a bit of some of my closest friends now, but he sort of was a mentor and a bit of a, I guess, a spirit guide for me when I was a young man getting into this world. And first expedition, proper expedition, I went on to Pakistan in 2014. He knew I was in the airport, and he just sent me a single text, and it just said, "Go gently." And I have thought about that every single time I've stepped on a plane to go to a mountain. Go gently. This idea that, like, whether you're spiritual or religious or not, I'm not religious, but I'm definitely spiritual. This idea that I don't think the mountain lets us pass through, but I like the idea that we need to sneak up on this mountain. We need to respect it. We need to accept that it is much bigger and scarier and dangerous, and it does not care about you. The idea of conquering something that big is for me the ultimate in arrogance.
Do you think that through your experiences and perhaps also from interviewing people on the Adventure podcast, that actually your definition or relationship with adventure has changed? Like, what would your definition be now?
I'm kind of glad you asked because I wasn't going to bring it up because I've bored people to death with my definitions. I think the dictionary definition of adventure, expedition, and exploration are all pretty antiquated and out of date, and we could do with updating them. But to focus on adventure, I read all the books that, and I use this term big inverted commas, that young brave men are supposed to read. I read the Captain Scotts and I read the Boningtons and all these brave men conquering landscapes. And I thought that's what adventure was. It was massive expeditions with huge potential for death. And now my version, I go on adventures with my toddler all the time. I'm not having an adventure, but she is. And in a way I am, because I'm noticing the world in a different way. But we go on adventures here, just out there. We have quite a lot of adventures in my garden. And it goes wrong for her all the time. And I think the closest I can come to as a definition is I think adventure is a journey of self with an unknown outcome. And I think what I mean by that, each of those points is important. So journey of self, because adventures are inherently selfish. I don't mean that in a negative way. So I'd say exploration requires us to bring something back, for a small group of people, for humanity, for the planet. An adventure, you're just allowed to go on one to experience it for you. It can be solo or with others, but it's a journey of self. The unknown outcome is really important. I think if there's a guaranteed known outcome, it's not going to be very adventurous by nature. It doesn't mean you have to fail, it doesn't mean you have to experience profound hardship, but I think there has to be an element of understanding that things might not go how you expect they will. And I think that's what generally makes adventures so special. And that's what I think a lot of us don't realize we're getting from them is we're forced into positions of confident decision making. We're forced to like retreat with our tail between our legs and assess what went wrong. And I think that's why if you actually look at any institution that takes young people on adventures, they tread gently to start with because the wrong adventure or an adventure at the wrong level can put somebody off adventure for life. Taking a load of 6-year-olds to abseil off a 100-meter cliff is a terrible idea. Taking them abseiling on a wooden plank that's 3 meters high, yeah, that works. I can see that. And so now, this is tangential again, but I need something. I thought I needed something pretty big to have an adventure because I've experienced so much. And I talked about Chernobyl. I also a part of a team that broke into a Russian space station, and we got arrested, and now we're banned from Russia. I kind of had all these experiences, and it just means that my baseline is very high now. But actually, again, as I've kind of matured and grown as a person, I've realized that that's not what I need, because the journey of self with an unknown outcome. Well, there's a piece of old growth woodland not far from my house that there's no map of. It's technically trespassing, but it's that civil right to roam trespass. So that's adventurous. I might meet somebody there who is going to say you need to go away, and I'll just say okay, that's fine, sorry. But I go there with my camera and I play. Running, I regularly have adventurous runs where I go off to the woods and I deliberately don't plan my route, and I say I'm going to go for an hour. Screw the distance, screw how my heart rate and all of that stuff. I'm just going to turn left there, or I wonder what's around that corner. I've not been that way before, and sometimes that goes a bit wrong because I get lost. And that can be quite exciting.
I love that because I think people quite often might presume that family life and adventure are incompatible and the complete antithesis to each other. But what I'm hearing is actually, parenthood doesn't have any known outcomes. You can't, certainly can't control the outcome. And you have to give over a bit of control, really, to the small people that you're bringing up. It's very much the same thing, really, isn't it?
It's the most extreme version of that. I mean, again, to reference my clever friend Matt Sharman, he said to me when I had kids, oh, he said, welcome to the grand adventure. That was the exact language he used. And again, it just hit me like a freight train. And I went, oh, okay, get that. And that's true. I mean, you can take any adventure parallel and turn it into a metaphor for something to do with parenting. And it's all an approach and attitude. I mean, I used to, it was half a joke. I thought I was being clever, you know, saying kind of, I'm in love with two things which are completely incompatible. And that's family life, being married, having kids, and this adventurous expedition-based lifestyle. They are completely compatible, and I owe it to both to make them compatible. So my toddler understands that I climb mountains and work in the mountains, and when we watch Disney films together, she says, those are mountains like Daddy climbs. And I have conversations with her about the mountains we're going to climb. I've got big plans for, like, you know, going to climb a hill nearby that's going to be our mountain. We're going to go and sleep in her playhouse this summer. You know, like, it's an attitude shift. I will get more out of sleeping in that playhouse than I will going Scotland to Scotland climbing for 4 days. Absolutely. I think, you know, if we're talking about parenting briefly, people, I know this anecdotally from the messages I get on Instagram, people see parenting as like the ultimate trap. And I think, again, it's this, like, don't want to say it's letting go of the ego or the arrogance, because I absolutely, right now, if I was being honest, I feel very devoid of adventure in my life, particularly at this moment. I haven't had one for a while and I'm craving it. It's a bit of a problem for me right now. But I think that these things are compatible. We just have to alter our expectations. You know, steal a night away, steal an hour away, plan a big adventure for the summer, big being 3 days. Plan a big adventure for 5 years. It's just, we can sit there and be mopey about how things have changed, or we can accept that A, parenting is the most difficult, amazing thing you will ever do. Or that's at least my experience. And we can still be adventurous within that. Absolutely.
And as we were saying, being present and living in the moment rather than necessarily always, I guess with adventures, it's always planning ahead, isn't it? You always got to have a plan for what you're going to do, whilst actually being able to acknowledge, right, here and now is what I'm doing. Well, that's a massive adventure in itself, isn't it?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think it's all headspace. We've talked about it. I think it's all how we frame things in our mind, because humans are narrative creatures, right? That's, we are generally, you know, some of us are more inclined to be like that than others, but we are, everything we think is based on a story. It's based on perception, societal expectation, how we view everything. And you can reframe that quite simply. I mean, to give you one more example, you know, I spend 3 or 4 nights a fortnight in London because of my wife's work, and I don't really want to be there. I make it quite adventurous for me and the kids. You know, we go down paths in Soho that I've never been down before, and sometimes I go for night walks, and I'm not saying they're necessarily edgy, but they're exploratory. I've not got Google Maps open. You know, I wander through Chinatown wondering what's around the next corner. Sometimes I wander into mysterious bars to have a drink. And I think I'm heavily influenced by that fiction I talked about that I read when I was younger. You know, it's walking into the saloon and having a chat with a stranger. My God, that's adventurous. You know, sometimes more so than walking up a mountain.
Yeah, it's we don't do it either, do we? So much definitely kind of like in urban life, certainly, and that hyper-connected life, people are happy to sit on their phones and engage with stories that are going on all over the world, but won't talk to the person next to them on the train. And that's really sad, I think, because there's
Yeah.
just a whole wealth of what is another person to learn from that, I think.
Yeah.
And I'm curious, just I know that we're possibly going to run slightly over, but if you've got time for it, just because we've been talking about this kind of unpicking the notion of adventure, and I think adventure is something that can feel somewhat inaccessible, for a variety of reasons. And I really wanted to give you the opportunity to just talk about the work that you're doing with the Adventure Film Accessibility Project and kind of the thinking behind that and why you also think it's necessary.
Yeah, sure. And I should say, just, you can cut this bit if you want to, but I don't have anywhere to be. So if you want to keep going, we can. I'm having a lot of fun. Yeah, absolutely. I think that project, I mean, I couldn't talk about it without giving a huge shout out to Tim Burton, who's head of production at Cold House. It was absolutely his idea, and a woman he met called Danielle Selwood. And again, this was another moment of, humility of him saying to me, "What about the people who can't watch these movies or who can't hear these movies?" Or, I've had a problem for a long time with just telling stories of brave white men climbing hills, which is my deliberately, half jokey way of talking about what I do. But that's what I did for a very long time. I made the sort of movies that I wanted to see, which, guess what they were? Look at me. I'm bearded, tattooed white man. And so we started telling more female stories. We're a 50% male female mix at Cold House. And that's not actually deliberate. That's just how it's played out. But then we pitched to a client to start talking about accessible film. And what we mean by that is two things. One is, and within the project that you're talking about, it's audio describing films so that they can be watched by people who are blind or visually impaired. And we also subtitle films and have a British Sign Language translator on films so that people who are deaf can understand what's happening in the film, can watch them, whichever way works for them, subtitled or with the sign language translator. And we found some funding to get the project off the ground. It was a loss-making project for quite a long time, but we saw the power of it so quickly. And the response from those communities was profound. So we then decided that we were going to formally pitch to every single client to say, "You should be doing this with every project we're making and you're making moving on. Don't just do it with ours." And we've committed as a company to doing it for everything we ever make, regardless of whether the client pays for it or not, which, with hindsight is difficult, but we are doing it. It's just sometimes we have to have difficult financial conversations, but we do it. We are doing it. And I feel like we have a duty to do it now. We've committed to it. I want to do it. On the other side of that is telling stories about people who don't look like me. I think it's so much, I can't think of a brilliant way to describe this, but generally we're more inspired by people who look like us. I think that's a known thing. So we recently, last year and the year before, we made a film with Adam Raja, a young guy of Pakistani heritage who ended up going to prison for drug dealing and found kind of solace, repentance, a future in the mountains. That story resonated with a huge, huge amount of people, but interestingly has gone on to redefine Adam's career. That was an unexpected outcome. And Adam's become one of my closest friends. I spent 90 minutes on the phone to him last night because I needed a chat with somebody. That's the other thing about film. The bonds forged are, I mean, it's like war. They just, it's, I'm so close. Made another film with Morag, and Morag's deaf. She wears a cochlear implant, and we made a film about her winter climbing and tried to show her experience of winter climbing. That film has done wonders for Morag, but also for the deaf community and also people's understanding of what it's like to be deaf. I've already spoken about Hamish and kind of coming out to the industry in that film, which was a huge ask. It took me 2 years to talk him into it, in an ethical way. But that's the other side of the accessible storytelling that we're talking about here is, are these films accessible to everyone? But are these films representative of everybody? And I feel like I don't want to say we have a duty to do it. I'm very wary of telling people that they have to do this, have to do that, because we're simultaneously told we have to save the world, go vegan, do this, do that, do that, do that. It's just too much. What I am saying is that we've chosen this as a bit of a fight. Of all the fights available to fight, this is one of ours. And I still make lots of films about white men in the mountains. I just make a lot more films these days about people who don't look like me, and I'm really proud of that.
And have you found that with sort of the demographic of your podcast as well? We haven't spoken so much about that, but you've said that like, you've had so many conversations. And I wonder, are those conversations changing, do you think?
Yeah, I think they have changed. I think in some ways for the better, and in some ways I'm a bit worried about it. So I think it's because my appetite has changed. I still love the outdoor world and the outdoor community and adventure. I'm sure I always will, but I'm still motivated by stories of those things and places, but I'd say I'm a bit more motivated by stories of change. So what's happening to the planet? What's happening to the environment? What's happening to people? Let's talk about gender in the outdoors. Let's talk about, all of these individual experiences. And sometimes worry I push that a bit too far, and I don't want to alienate an audience. I'm trying to Trojan horse it in a way. I'm trying to, like, hey, come and listen to the adventure podcast because it's amazing, rip-roaring tales of adventure. But I don't want it to be Red Bull. It never has been. But the demographic has changed, partly by accident. And I'm now very conscious of making sure it's not just brave, bold, white mountaineers. But I mean, there was a lady called Orla who was working as a producer on the podcast. And on International Women's Day, she sent me the stats of our episodes. And I think it was 32% women and 5% non-white. And I just was like, okay, I get the point. Very clever on International Women's Day. Well done. So I committed to changing that. But interestingly, and I am happy to talk about this, my anecdotal evidence is that it's very rare a man says no to being asked for an interview. 50%, I would guess, of the women I ask say no. So actually, find it being able to create, like trying consciously to create a gender balance on the adventure podcast is very, very difficult. And I try. Which I think you can probably take a quick stab at why that is. I mean, men love talking about how brilliant they are. They're natural PR machines. Yeah, it's interesting.
I do have quite a lot of women who sometimes will be like, but this is, aside from maybe the bigger names who might feel like, but why do you want to talk to me? What have I
Absolutely.
done? It's like, you're amazing.
Yeah.
Please have come chat, or will I say the right thing? And I found it myself. I did my first kind of me being interviewed on a podcast, and I was a nervous wreck because I didn't have like a script, and I talking about myself was just this horrendous pressure to kind of like represent myself in the right way and things. And I found it far more stressful than being the one asking the questions. And that was a valuable experience, I think, because then it made me walk in the shoes of someone who's been approached to do that. And it made me realize, okay, maybe that's why people are saying no.
Yeah, totally. I absolutely felt like that today. I mean, I even during the conversation, I'm going, why have you just said all that? Why are you rambling so much about that? Why are you so useless at that? Doing all the self-loathing and then going, no, you've been asked to be here. It's like that ego seesaw is, rocking up and down right now.
Well, everything you've said is incredible. So, and so eloquent. So please never don't fear about
Thank you.
that. But what is, you said things are changing, and what is your vision kind of both in terms of where your own work is going, and then maybe a little bit more broadly as well in terms of the adventure filmmaking industry?
That's interesting. I have to be slightly careful with that latter one. I think the industry is changing in some ways for the better and in some ways for the worse. I think I would rather not be too specific, but what I will say is that some parts of the industry are going kind of more sensationalist, Bear Grylls-ian than ever before, at speed. And I worry about that. Now, in some ways, it makes adventure more accessible, making the kind of sensationalist, absolutely entertainment, borderline not documentary work. People want to watch that stuff. And if that inspires people to get into the outdoors and fall in love with nature, then maybe that's the first step towards becoming a, armchair environmentalist, which is what I'm advocating. But on the other hand, I feel like it's a little bit the death of authenticity. I worry that this idea of conquest, again, I'm not going to be too specific. I'd maybe be specific with a couple of names, but there are some big players in the adventure world right now who have become famous recently, who talk about conquering mountains, and I think they need to, sort themselves out. It's an ego trip, and what they're advocating is bad. It's bad. It's this idea of self, grandeur, essentially. I think on the opposite end, and I will talk about this a bit more specifically, is the outdoor brands who really have to listen to their audiences and their consumers. The ones that I work for are, and I think I'm really actually buoyed up by, the outdoor brands are people. I think that's one thing we don't often re remember is that these are like as employed people who work there. And what I'm noticing, I have close relationships with a lot of them, is that they're not saying, "Hey, Matt, have you got any like tokenized stories we can tell so that we can tick a box for the brand?" They're saying, "How can we champion the love of the outdoors? How can we make our world more accessible?" And I'm like, "Great question. Here's some answers." So I think, and the brands are recognizing that telling stories of brave white men climbing mountains, we will do that forever, and we should, because white men want to feel like they can go and climb mountains to be brave, but we've got the balance all wrong. And reframing how we speak about those men is important. But I'm noticing that the brands are obsessing over telling more accessible stories and stories that matter, human stories of obviously different types of people from all walks of life, whether that's gender, religion, race, etc. Culture, class is a big one that we don't talk about much, that I feel quite passionately about.
Yeah, no, we don't. We don't. Actually, I think you're probably one of the first people that I've heard mention it in terms of that. Well, this arena, certainly. And we don't talk about it as a society very much as well because it's uncomfortable, right? But we've got to get comfortable with it.
Oh yeah, I mean, all I'll say without getting my soapbox out is, I'll phrase it semi cryptically, I'm from Grimsby. I didn't go to Eton, and I know a lot of people who did. Our world is full of, at the top level, is full of the privately educated. No issue with it necessarily. Like, my wife was privately educated, but I wasn't. And I do get a little bit uppity sometimes about the fact that we don't talk about what we could call the economic differences, and the economic barriers to the outdoors. I mean, if anybody is interested in that stuff, go and read Nick Hay's work on the Right to Rent campaign. I've forgotten the title of his book, which is really annoying me. The Book of Trespass. He talks a lot about the economy and how actually, families from certain economies don't own cars, and the trains to get into national parks are prohibitively expensive, etc. I'm on a tangent, but yeah, that was, you asked about the industry. In my view, I'll do this a bit more succinctly. So all I wanted to do was have adventures, and my access, my ticket to tell it to going on adventures was telling stories. And that was where this all started. And then I realized I could make money doing it. I'm by no means wealthy. I live in a rented house. I drive a white van, but I think there's potential that, one day I could be. It seems like it's going that way. And I'm not going to deny that or try and stop that from happening. What I'm interested in, though, my passion, my purpose, the Japanese ikigai, what is your purpose? I think mine is connecting people with nature. I've sort of recognized it through my skill set and my passion. My job isn't to be the science communicator or the environmentalist. It's the David Attenborough quote that, we'll never protect what we don't love, and we won't love what we haven't experienced. I'm hopefully providing, I'm the conduit for experience. Look at this place, go and experience this place, go and have adventures, get lost in them. And then hopefully you'll go on the journey that I've been on, which is realizing that these places that we love, well, they're under threat, and there are things that we can do about that. And so I think Cold House will always make films about adventures, but we are doing this already, and we're now going to be doing it more at speed, is humanitarian, environmental, biodiversity, storytelling, working with NGOs, hopefully making big films about these issues in these places. We just started our third, and it's a very recent thing, but it's something I'm really excited about. So that's, the long-term plan. It was a much longer conversation, but that's the direction I want to take things in.
And you said you're itching for an adventure. Is there one planned?
So this is what I mean about this whole like law of diminishing returns. So in the next 5 months, it's looking likely that I'm definitely going to Bhutan for a week on like a ridiculous, ridiculous experience. I'm probably going to be going to to Switzerland. Be there for 2 weeks making ski films, probably. and I may be going to climb the Matterhorn. That's not what I'm talking about. These are projects, they're jobs. And yeah, they'll be amazing, but I'll be at work. I don't have anything in the diary. And actually, two of my closest friends have said to me, the next time we speak, you better have something in the calendar. And I think what I'm going to do, I was talking to my wife about it yesterday, is I'm going to find some childcare. I'm lucky I've got two grannies nearby. It's by design. So I don't live in a mountainous area. I live in the flattest county in England, so I can have the childcare. I'm going to get the sleeper train to Fort William with a single rucksack, and I'm just going to go and wander around the mountains for 4 days. I'm not going to try and climb the hardest thing I've ever climbed. I'm not going to try and peak bag. I'm just going to go out into the wilds for 4 days and have an experience. That's it. And that is enough for me, despite everything I've done and everything I've experienced. I just want to go and be self-reliant in the natural world without an agenda. Yeah, the other day I thought, I was feeling a bit down. I thought I might just drive to Cornwall, go and get in the sea at night in the waves and just wallow about in the waves for an hour and then drive home. Didn't do it, but I really wanted to.
And frolic in the icy Cornish waters, and that'll
Yeah.
reset the system for sure.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
But I've had so much fun talking to you. I get the sense that we could probably talk for hours and hours about all kinds of things. But I am mindful of your time, even though you've generously said that there's nowhere to be. So I'm going to say thank you and ask you the final question, which I ask all my guests, which is, what does joy mean to you?
Well, you did give me some notice on this, but I deliberately didn't think about it too much. And I'm going to try and be impulsive with my answer. I think if I'm organically honest, my answer is I find joy now most easily and most authentically in the little things and in moments of presence. So joy for me is not standing on stage winning awards. It's not seeing, money roll into the bank. I find joy in tiny little moments. And some of those are being present with my kids when they're being cute and funny. Some of those are in the woodpecker that appeared in my garden the other day. That was a first. That was amazing. Some of those are in reading a page of a book that resonates more than anything has in a long time. Drinking a cup of coffee in the morning after a, wet and windy night on the hill. Like, for me, generally, I've learned, I'm 35, I'm not old and wise, but I've realized that generally joy comes from the little things.
I'm so grateful to the community that is growing around the podcast, and if you've enjoyed today's episode, I would so appreciate if you can share it with your communities and help spread the message of support, perseverance, and joy further. If you have any feedback or suggestions for future guests, you can find me on Instagram at running_on_joy. I'd love to hear from you. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time for Running on Joy.